Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Social media is more popular than ever, especially among school-aged children who have transferred some of the schoolyard chatter, including the bullying, online. Sadly, the consequences are not just virtual. Online bullying has led to well-publicized offline tragedy. To address this problem, one California school district has hired a company to monitor their students' social media posts. Joining us now by phone from Hermosa Beach, California, to discuss monitoring students' online activity is Chris Friedrich. He's CEO of GeoListening. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Thank you, Anne.
Describe how your company operates in these kinds of assignments, how you monitor students.
Yeah, so I think a clarifying point would be that we actually don't monitor students specifically. We monitor social network posts, and that alleviates some of the paranoia that's out there that we're actually tracking students individually.
Okay.
And I think that's an important delineation to make so that the public understands that we're not being provided information in any way by school districts other than what schools they would like to monitor. The rest of it is very much a manual as well as technological effort by us to come up with the students that are posting things that are related to each given school site.
Are you looking for keywords, phrases, that sort of thing?
Keywords are part of what we look for. You know, the interesting thing about social is that there's always different things in each and every post. Sometimes it's a picture, and it's very simple and easy to understand what's going on mm-hmm. with the supporting text that's there. And oftentimes it leads us to other pages of social networks that we may not be actively monitoring. So it's it is very much a quest, if you will, to make sure that when we find something that is a violation of the student's code of conduct or a disruption to public education attainment, that we bring not only the post itself, but we bring supporting information. An example of that was on the first day of school where a young lady had posted that she was sad. And our analysts thought that was odd, even though none of us like to go to work on Monday morning, certainly don't like to go back to school after a nice summer. And on the young lady's page, she had posted two other times from the school bus on her way to school that she had almost gotten into a fight on the very first day of school and that the bullying had started already. And in going back on her publicly available information on her page, you could see that she had basically gotten her self-confidence back over the summer, but in the previous school year, we saw evidence of her being bullied repeatedly.
So that's it. At that point, you notify the district what you know and then leave it to them.
Yeah, I mean, we're no different than any other parent that could walk in. The difference is that we're able to look at a lot more than any single individual or any single administration of a district. I mean, it's a massive amount of information. In some of our schools, we see kids that are posting once every 5 minutes or even more frequently. And obviously that is in and of itself a distraction to their educational attainment.
Is that something the district wants to know, too, or that is of interest to schools, how much they're on?
You know, it's not that how much they're on. It is truly that statement of educational distraction. Some schools allow for children to have cell phones or obviously other devices that are there for their use in their learning attainment. But when they're on social networks that the school districts have blocked on the infrastructure, and then they pull a private device out of their pocket and go onto a public social network while they're sitting in class mm-hmm. where they're supposed to be learning whatever that subject matter is, that certainly is a concern of the school district.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's Tech Tuesday, and right now I'm talking with Chris Friedrich. He's CEO of GeoListening. Schools hire companies like GeoListening to help them monitor the activity of students with the onset of online bullying. If you have a question or comment for Chris, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. How do you measure the success of your service? How do you know it's successful?
You know, that's a great question. When we concepted it originally, we looked at the monitoring piece because it's very easy. I mean, you could do it yourself if you just popped open any social network, typed in a word, you could find different things related to schools and children in schools and so on. But we have actually altered and now are adding on October 1st a mobile application so that we can empower more people. We measure success by school climate and how positive a school climate is on each and every campus. And we realized that just monitoring isn't going to get it. We wanted to empower the kid that feels like they're being bullied or having some kind of experience that they want to talk to an adult about, as well as the parents and staff members of that respective site. So that way they can get information into the system so that adults that are there every day to help and assist and guide have the right information to work from. And that system's completely anonymous. So it's a paradigm shifting endeavor that we're taking on. And we realize that much like many other things our society takes on, the more people that you have bound to the mission, the better things can be and much faster. I think that the question that you posed and the challenge in people's minds is they look at the cost of what our service is for this particular district that's been publicized, and they try to draw a line to value. I don't know how to draw that line because oftentimes we have seen it result in the intervention on behalf of a student that was going to end their life. And if this is not just the first post that a child had made, these are deep, dark, repeated posts by a student over an extended period of time. And when we find the post that draws our attention to them, it's definitively a challenge for that student. And we've been able to get several of those students help over the last couple of months.
As a rule, are students informed that they're being monitored? And why would they not just make their profiles private, or isn't there some way they can beat you at your own game?
You know, it's a great question. Every school makes their determination in accordance with their existing policy.
Okay.
And different groups of students have different rights by law. 13 and older are one set, and then 12 and unders are another set of students that are governed by a law called COPPA. And so those students or parents are notified by the district and permission is attained or opt out is given. As far as beating us at our own game, you know, it's interesting, the adults that don't know how to program a VCR clock, and I'm sure there are still some blinking in living rooms across the country, just don't understand social very well. You know, the general public thinks of email as password and user ID, and then that's very, very private where everything you send and receive is all in that email box. And most people, I think, understand that. Social is a little bit different in that sense where when you have a username and password, it's your publishing license. And once you're inside your own personal publishing company, you make a conscious decision to publish privately or publicly, and you can do that actually based on every single post. So the notion of adults thinking that students don't know they're public, it couldn't be further from the truth. They fully are aware that they are posting in the public domain. If they do decide to privatize their accounts, which we highly encourage them to do, the notion is we're trying to catch kids. We're not trying to catch kids. We're trying to help kids not prevent something from being a good thing for them in their lives. So when we found a student last year with weapons on their page posting about having a fight off campus with older kids that had graduated from school, we look at that and we say, well, wait a minute. Yeah, you're arranging a fight, but what about the weapons that are pictured on your page, which is that student's right to post that picture? But the two together could cause a dramatic shift in his life path. And that's something that we look at and we say, you know, consequences. Part of being a kid is understanding and learning consequences and life experiences and coping skills. But kids are being propelled into this virtual world where it is truly global and there is no behavioral proper use guide.
Let's go back to COPPA. That is a California law, right?
No, that's federal.
That's a federal law.
Managed by FTC.
Okay. And there are critics who say that this is violating the students' rights to privacy and free speech. And how have you grappled with that issue in the work that you do?
So we are very diligent about what we report to the district. So each and every school, I believe now, all of our clients at least, have a student code of conduct. If you look at the state of New York, there's actually a dignity law that's tied to bullying and bullying intervention. So we only align to the rules of a district. This is not anyone in our company's personal interpretation of something. This is looking at the rules and aligning what we report based on the rules. So a student can say whatever they choose about their particular school. However, if they have signed a dignity contract with their school and their parents also sign off on those things at the beginning of the school year, then they are saying, I can say what I want, but I have to conduct myself within the guidelines of this agreement that I'm making with my institution and my parents. So, you know, it's not us saying that the student can't talk about school. They're signing a document that says they can talk about school, but they have to do it within the rules. So they can't say school is awful because Mr. Jones is a such and such and is making my life bleepity bleep. That violates, in several of our existing clients, that violates a vulgarity and obscenity rule that is in their student code of conduct. So we do adhere to all of the federal laws. However, some students and parents are basically saying those laws are great to protect our students and our stakeholders. However, we want to have a different school climate, and these are the rules that we agree to by sending our student to the school, or as the student says, I am a member of this school community, and I am agreeing to act in an appropriate way based on this document.
Some people have compared it to this locker searches that are pretty common now. When all kids are in class, they'll announce we're now starting a locker search and everyone has to stay. You know, they do kind of a lockdown and no one is allowed to get to their lockers. And some people have complained about the privacy issues of that, but it was on campus. So it's school property and so forth. But social media, is that pretty common, to as far as you know, in these school policies now?
I think if you look, it's still evolving.
Okay.
I know that one state, the second largest in student population in the country, they have evolved their law from only things that happen on campus were under the purview of the district. And the state law changed because of incidents such as we've seen in the national press on the tragedies of students. And they've now said that if it exists on the campus, yes. If it creates an educational distraction for any student or becomes a threat, then that doesn't matter where it has happened. And I think you'll probably, you know, Florida had adopted their laws a little bit earlier than the most recent tragedy, but I wouldn't be surprised to see legislations taking this up. But again, it's each individual state can interpret these parameters differently, and I think it's evolving, and we're starting to see it accelerate in evolving towards the protection of kids. I don't think that it's the school reaching out further. It's when schools can be held accountable for school climate, but then be not have the backing of the community. So one of the examples I gave, this will help crystallize this. I asked an interviewer the other day, who owns the responsibility of having a good school climate? And they looked at me and they said, well, the school, they're responsible for creating a good school climate, a safe and learning environment. And I said, well, that's interesting. I said, in your house, who's responsible for a good climate? He said, well, my wife and I. I said, okay. I said, do your children have any responsibility in that? And I said, well, sure. They have chores, they have responsibilities and rules they have to abide by. And I said, what about if any friends come over? Do they have a responsibility to adhere to your climate? And he said, yeah. And I said, then why do we think it any different for the schools where we send our children? Why aren't we all an active participant and take up some responsibility other than just looking at the school and saying, everything that happens to my kid is your fault because it happened while they were in your schoolhouse?
What about parents of children? Because we've heard of those, too, of parents getting online and bullying students.
Yeah, you know, we've seen just about everything, and we can report. Again, we don't monitor students specifically.
Right.
So, you know, we see teachers being harassed. We see staff members being harassed. We see all kinds of things that occur. As you know, schools are not just for children, but you have groups that rent facilities over weekends. You have Friday night football games where the community comes out. And, you know, there's usually incidents that occur a lot of times throughout a school year that have nothing to do with the student body. So, you know, we're here to make sure the school climate is right. That means, you know, if you throw a football through a trophy case on the weekend in a facility where your group may have been renting it and you post it to social media, you'll make the district report.
I see. Okay.
So, again, you know, it's not about monitoring students. We're not out to get kids. I think that's the general notion, that we're taking away privacy and liberty, and we're really not. We encourage students to privatize their accounts. The interesting thing is the adults are taking the initial news reports and taking this down a lot of pathways of fear and NSA and Big Brother. When we've been interviewed by the students in the schools that we actually work with, and they understand how we do not use deceptive business practices, that means we don't friend them fake names or anything like that. We don't have their passwords. The schools don't give us any information about them. They actually feel good about what we're doing because they know we're just truly there to help make sure they've got the best learning environment possible. And with our mobile application being completely anonymous, friends can actually help other friends without compromising that friendship. So when a student sees something happening to a friend, whether it's by another or within their own mind, they're able to report that in and yet still be there for their friend. And, you know, the two-way communication is also anonymous. So if somebody reports something into the system, an administrator can communicate back and ask a question without that student losing that that anonymity. Mm-hmm. And that goes for parents and staff members as well.
Well, Chris Friedrich, we're going to have to end it there. Thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Chris Friedrich is CEO of Geo Listening. It's a company that is hired to monitor social media and protect schools, students, and others. We'll be right back and talk about more on Tech Tuesday when we return. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We've heard about the so-called driverless cars still in development at many companies. Some of us dream of traveling to work with a sense of ease, sipping our lattes and skimming the headlines on our built-in tablets. At this point, we should keep dreaming. Safety issues and other hurdles must be overcome before driverless cars hit the road. And the greatest hurdle? Joining us now to talk about that is Bianca Bosker. She's the executive technology editor for the Huffington Post and joins us by phone from New York. Welcome to the show, Bianca.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So if it's not merging and it's not parallel parking, what is the most dangerous thing about a car that supposedly can drive itself?
Right. So the ironic thing about self-driving cars is that researchers now think that the scariest, most dangerous, and least understood part of building them is us. The humans. So when we think about driverless cars, I think people assume they're almost these mobile living rooms, right? Google, Mercedes, Ford, et cetera, will basically give us these cars where we can get inside, kick back, and like you described, drink our coffee, take a nap, catch up on email, et cetera. Really, though, the first generation of driverless cars are probably more likely to be like airplanes now, where you've got this autopilot system that's in charge for a lot of the time, but every once in a while runs into a situation it can't handle and has to pass back over control of the car to the driver. So driverless cars won't make the driver obsolete initially. They're more likely to make the driver optional in certain situations.
But doesn't that require even more alertness?
Right. So that's what researchers are looking at right now. So I think, all right, we've more or less figured out how to build self-driving cars. The question is, can we build people that can drive them? It turns out that that's actually very dangerous and not well understood, that handoff between the driver and the car. So let's say you're driving down the highway, the car comes to a construction zone, it's not quite sure what to do with that, and so it says, hey, Bianca, I need you, can you take over in this situation? What people are trying to figure out is, well, first of all, how alert am I going to be? What happened, you know, am I going to be able to quickly step in? How much notice do I need? What information should the car give me so I can safely take over? What happens if I don't take over? How are my driving skills going to be if I've been used to my robot chauffeur? And it turns out that those questions are not well understood. And so I went to Stanford University, where Clifford Nass, a professor and researcher there, has built this incredible $600,000 simulator that's going to basically be getting people to practice trading off control with these automated cars and studying how they react. How distracted are they? How flustered? How focused?
It seems to me that someone who has a lot of experience driving cars for a long period of time is going to be better at this. But it concerns me that people most likely to want to do this or use them are people who don't like to drive, who aren't very good drivers. And then when that time comes, when the drive, you know, the car says, Bianca, I want you to jump in here. Well, is Bianca as good of a driver?
Right. Well, so we can take, when we start to think about this, it's helpful actually to look at what's happening with aviation. And autopilot systems have made flying much, much safer. And, you know, right now, I mean, there's just a couple minutes of the flight where those autopilot systems are not in charge. And you're absolutely right. So what we've seen is the FAA actually warned about this in a safety brief they came out with earlier this year, where they said, you know, there's this problem of automation complacency or automation addiction in the cockpit, where pilots are getting so used to relying on these autopilot systems that they may be forgetting how to fly, which is terrifying to me.
Exactly.
But basically, they were saying, you know, they warned airlines, you need to give your pilots time to practice hand flying the plane. And researchers are thinking that that problem is only going to be magnified when you move it over to the car. I mean, think about it. We've got, you'd never let a teenager in the cockpit of a 777, right? And yet teens are driving all over the road. You know, we as drivers get very little training, very little upkeep on our skills, where pilots get, you know, years of instruction and are constantly seeing, you know, their skills maintained. So that is absolutely a worry. You know, will we become reliant on this automation, and as a result, will our driving skills degrade? And the answer is probably yes, which means for that interim time, that maybe first generation of driverless cars that will require us to step in occasionally, we could be in a lot of trouble. Also remember, I mean, the margin of error on a road is very, very little. I mean, you're constantly in danger of bumping into something when you drive, where that's not as true necessarily in the skies. You've got a little more room in general.
Is the eventual goal, as far as the companies and the people who are developing these cars, is the eventual goal to switch the responsibility of driving completely over to the car? I mean, we've watched sci-fi movies.
I think the eventual goal long-term is absolutely this full automation. But right now, drivers are car companies are distinguishing between highly automated and fully automated. So fully automated, I think, absolutely, is the long-term goal. But, you know, car companies are having to negotiate, well, you know, do we just wait until we get there? That's probably not as realistic. It's probably more realistic that the initial version of those vehicles are these more, you know, highly automated, passing over kind of autopilot vehicles.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's Tech Tuesday, and my guest in this segment is Bianca Bosker, technology editor for the Huffington Post. We're talking about driverless cars. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org as well, or check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. What are some of the way? Well, first of all, let's get to the distraction issue and the idea that we want to be able to sit and have our coffee and, you know, read our paper too or read our tablet too. A lot of these cars that are getting geared up to be driverless, they're considered luxury cars. These are going to be luxuries at first. They're also very, you know, decked out in a lot of other stuff, like the built-in tablets, like the built-in television sets, right on the, not hanging down from the ceiling for the kids in the back seat, but right there in front of you while you're driving. Is there any sense that maybe they ought to pull back on some of that while they're, you know, while they're rolling out the driverless stuff?
So, yeah, that's definitely a concern, right? You have these cars with these increasingly sophisticated infotainment systems, which will even in some cases update Facebook for the driver. But look, the longer-term goal of having cars that drive themselves would in all likelihood solve not only that problem, but the whole problem of drunk driving, drowsy driving, and distracted driving, right? I mean, machines in general have much faster reaction times than we do, and they're more reliable drivers. I mean, at this point, the technology is still maturing. It's, of course, not there all the way, but looking farther ahead, there might be one-off events that these driverless cars, you know, take a long, long time to master, right? The really unexpected, strange things that their engineers can't develop algorithms for them to handle. But really, I mean, drivers are a very human drivers are completely imperfect technology. When it comes to who's at the wheel of the car, I mean, I think you know, a robot doesn't get drunk, right? And there's a major source of accidents that we could see potentially remedied by this technology. I think the other really interesting thing they're working on right now, and this researcher at Stanford, Clifford Nass in particular, is this idea of how do we get the car to not only watch the road, but watch the driver? So he has this really interesting idea of the car as the wingman, or the car as the teammate. And he talks about how, you know, maybe we could get to a point where the car is actually reading a lot of your own signals and reacting accordingly. Some car makers are already doing this, actually. I mean, Ford's new campaign that they've had for a while now is about the car that cares, and Mercedes has a technology that will ostensibly tell when the driver is getting drowsy and beginning to kind of veer side to side, and basically alert them that they should pull over, get some coffee, take a nap, etc. But looking farther down, I mean, the people that will be going into the simulator at Stanford doing this automated vehicle research are going to be hooked up to all kinds of sensors. They have EEG sensors that measure their brain activity. They've got EKG sensors that measure their heart rates. They have skin conductance sensors that mention how aroused they are, their emotional state, and these eye tracking glasses. And, you know, if we think about it, that's obviously in the lab, but it's not inconceivable that cars could one day really watch out for how you are feeling and then try and automatically react to that. Nass describes it almost as the car that's a friend, right? So it tells that it can tell that you're getting tired and it offers to drive you home. You know, even Ford talks about this idea of a car that knows what you're allergic to and tries to help, maybe filters the air in the vehicle itself.
It really does sound like Kip.
Yeah, well, it's fascinating because if you think about it, I mean, it stands to be the biggest revolution in the way we drive to date. I mean, I think if you got into a car that was built in the 40s or 50s, you probably wouldn't have too hard of a time driving it or figuring it out. And right now we're on the cusp of really revolutionizing our relationship with our cars. They go, as NAF observes, they go from the slave to the teammate.
Edward in Columbus, you're on the air with Bianca Bosker of the Huffington Post. Welcome.
Hello, Ms. Bianca. My name is Edward Concepcion. I've been out here in Ohio since 98 trying to sell an idea to get rid of all traffic.
Is that noise coming from... Is that you, Bianca?
There's a fire alarm going
off. Okay. All right, Edward, sorry to cut you off like that. Can you go on?
Would your idea resolve traffic congestions all in and out of our cities all across the United States?
Yeah, will it help with traffic jams?
Yeah, exactly. So that's the thinking behind driverless cars is the automakers are promising that it's not only safer, but we could see commutes that are more efficient and perhaps speedier. So if you think about stop-and-go traffic, you actually waste a lot of time, of course, but also a lot of fuel. You're braking, you're going, you're braking, you're gassing. And the idea is that these automated cars could communicate more effectively with each other, drive closer together with each other because their reaction times are faster and these kind of long platoons, which would help us squeeze more cars onto the road and also potentially avoid the stop and go. So their promise is that this technology could, yes, reduce traffic congestion and also reduce the wasted fuel that we spend waiting in traffic and stopping and going.
Thank you, Edward, for that call. Paul in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Paul.
Good morning. So far from what we've heard about the Google cars, and I know there's other companies and universities working on it, but the Google car seems to be quite successful after a couple hundred thousand miles at least of testing. I think they had one incident that was the fault of the human on board. What does your research show about that? Are we kind of being misled or... What's going on?
No, not at all. I think that the bigger point is not that they're not doing incredible groundbreaking research and getting closer and closer to a point where driverless cars are a reality. I think that we are getting to that point. But the point is that there will be, before we step into this absolutely self-driving car, it's more likely that we're going to have to go through this intermediate phase where we still take over from time to time. So, I think my understanding and research is that Google has really pushed the envelope and also forced the hand of these car companies who, to some extent, now look like they're playing catch-up, even though I'm quite certain they've been doing research into mm-hmm. automation all along. But I think it's not that we're not – that Google's not going to get us there or that these car companies won't get us there. It's that the first driverless cars that we're able to buy and go, you know, drive out on the road aren't going to be these Jetson-style living rooms.
I want my jetpack. on the same note, in a way, are we going to get sort of a Model T version of this? In other words, something that most people can afford? Or is it going to be more like what I mentioned earlier, pure luxury, and only the very wealthiest people will be able to afford it?
I think that's a great question. I think it's early to too early to tell potentially. I think already you're seeing little types of automation making its way into more high-end luxury vehicles, but technology moves very quickly, and so it's not inconceivable that, let's say, Toyota puts it into the Lexus cars, but the next year it goes into its Toyota cars, right? But it's still incredibly expensive. I mean, I think that the research, I think that Google said that it cost them maybe $100,000 to equip their driverless cars. I'd have to check that stat. But the answer is, I'm not sure. I'm not sure anyone knows for sure how much it'll be. But most likely it will be a more high-end luxury car that gets in initially.
All right. Well, Bianca, thanks so much for joining us today. We appreciate it as usual.
Thank you. Thanks for the great questions, too.
Bianca Bosker, she's executive technology editor for the Huffington Post. Coming up, Russell Halley, tech blogger for Geek.com. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. When last we spoke with Geek.com tech blogger Russell Holley, he was poised to jump into the Big Apple media event. There were a few surprises. Rather, many of the internet rumors were confirmed. And now that the dust has settled, Russell Holley is back to talk about what he's heard and what he heard and what he's learned since. Hi, Russell.
Hi.
So first off, and maybe this is an obvious question, but the new iPhones are called the 5S and the 5C. Do we know what the S and the C stand for?
The S is just kind of the iterative upgrade that Apple has done for the last couple of phones. They've done, you know, the 4 and then the 4S and now the 5 and then now the 5S. Okay. So that's just that's their kind of intermediate name that they give in between these kind of big number versions.
Mm-hmm.
I think the original one, the S, meant speed, you know, where it was a speed increase. But in this one, they certainly did a lot more than just a performance increase. And then the C is for color.
Okay, so it is something just as simple as color.
Yeah, very, very basic names, you know, and that's kind of Apple's thing for all their products is kind of very, very basic names for their things. But so we have, for the first time ever, two different iPhones being launched at the exact same time. We have the iPhone 5C, which really is not terribly different from the iPhone 5. If you already have an iPhone 5 and you're not going to get a lot out of this particular upgrade if you decide to go with a C, it's a plastic casing instead of the metallic casing that is on the current iPhone 5, and just ever so slightly thicker, but it comes in a couple of different colors, and it will be $100 cheaper than the iPhone 5S on shelves.
This is the 5C.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, $100 less. Does that matter that much in this market?
I really don't think it does. I think, well, from the perspective of most, you know, I guess from adults who are going to walk in and look at the shelves and see, you know, it's $100. As long as it can be adequately explained what the difference between the C and the S are, I think most people would just spend the extra $100 and go with the S.
What are the big differences in your mind?
There's actually a couple of them. There's a significant processor difference between the two devices. There's a big camera difference between the two devices, and there's a new fingerprint scanner on the 5S that makes, if you decide to use it, that makes things like unlocking your phone or purchasing things on the App Store or iTunes Music significantly faster.
Now, I thought that the camera on the 5S wasn't that much or wasn't an improvement over the 5.
So it's it definitely is. What you see there is that it's the same number of megapixels.
Okay.
They are both still 8-megapixel cameras, but there are two really substantial differences between the two cameras. The first is that the 5S will have a 1.5 micron sensor as opposed to a 1.4 micron sensor. And that's a really technical explanation for something that means that there are bigger pixels being used to capture more information for your pictures. So while it is still an 8-megapixel sensor, it will be capable of taking dramatically better photos in certain situations, things like low light or you know, where there's a lot of different colors going on. This sensor is going to be more capable of processing that information faster. So in that area, you'll see some really subtle differences between how those pictures are taken. But the other really important thing is that the flash on the 5S is a huge technological improvement over really any mobile flash. This is using a pair of flash LEDs on the back that are actually working in tandem to gauge what kind of environment you're taking a picture in and adjust the color and the tone of the light that comes out of the flash to better accompany the picture that's being taken.
And it'll
a
do
lot
this
of times you take,
go ahead.
A lot of times you take pictures with flash and it ends up washing out a photo or being too harsh a light. And this is designed to create a much better light for whatever environment you're in.
And does this do this automatically or is it just an option that you can adjust?
No. This is something that'll happen automatically. If you have the flash on, it will detect the kind of picture you're taking and adjust the light from the back of the phone to enhance that photo.
Okay, gotta love that. I mean,
yeah,
anything automated.
It should be. I haven't actually used it yet, so I can't say for sure. But it should be a really dramatic thing for people who go to take pictures, especially those who, you know, for me anyway, it's one of the first things I do when I get a camera is turn the flash off. on a phone, because a lot of times it does. It ends up ruining a picture if you're not, you know, in a very specific environment.
So if you're satisfied with the iPhone 5 camera, that's pretty much what you're going to get on the 5C.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, you'll get pretty much the exact same thing. The differences between the iPhone 5 and the iPhone 5C really are external. You've got that plastic casing and the difference between, you know, five different colors, and that's really it. The difference between the 5 and the 5S are going to become more apparent over time than they are, you know, when you first take them out of the box. I mean, you do have the improved camera and the fingerprint sensor is going to be really cool. But Apple actually used a different processor architecture in the hopes that developers will move to this standard and create, better applications, better, you know, games that use better graphics and things like that. So for the 5S, you know, what you're going to get out of the box, you know, day one is probably, it's going to be faster than the iPhone 5, but not enough to make you feel like you really need this. But in about 6 months, developers will have caught up and released applications that'll take advantage of this new processor and make it a much bigger deal. So if you're kind of towards the end of an upgrade, it's something you can wait for and still get a really great phone.
So you can still use everything that the 5S has. The 5 has.
Right.
But it'll just get better as the developers catch up. They'll just it'll enhance everything.
Exactly.
And the 5C, what's the deal with the colors? Because you can, you can buy covers for them now. You can do anything you want. I mean, it's ridiculous. What do they stand to gain from doing that?
To be blunt, you know, they've created a whole new category of device. You know, in the past, Apple has taken the previous generation. If the 5C didn't exist, then they would take the iPhone 5 and they'd knock it down $100 and they'd have it on the shelf. So you'd be able to get the 5, or the 5S when it's sitting on the shelf. And as of right now, you can't buy an iPhone 5 from Apple. They don't exist at all. They've removed them from the shelves entirely. And so you have two different devices that you can choose from now, one of which I suspect, and we'll know more over the next week to be absolutely sure, but I suspect has a significantly lower bill of materials. It ends up costing Apple, I'm assuming, I do not know 100% for sure, but it costs Apple significantly less to manufacture the plastic iPhone 5C than it would to continue manufacturing the iPhone 5.
So why not throw in some color?
Exactly, yeah. And it's got the same color palette as the iPods, which have all been, you know, really popular in the past. Each one of those colors has got, you know, kind of their own group of fans.
Right. Moisha in Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
So I had kind of a question about the flash. It sounded to me when I watched the videos for the iPhone that the flash that they're using to balance just has an amber balance for tungsten light. But I think that, you know, probably half the photos out there are taken under fluorescent light, and it didn't sound like they were going to have any adjustments, which would have to be a green filter to reach that Kelvin level. So I don't know if that was just omitted and if that's going to be the case, but it just didn't sound to me like it's going to replace the camera in my pocket in that sense, and then shooting in lower light, because that's really the biggest problem that I have with my phone is just shooting in that lower light and, you know, being able to stop motion and then also balance it with any type of light that I have.
So I think that what you'll find, and we're getting, I'm happy to answer this question, but we're getting really technical, I think, as far as camera technology.
I was going to say, do you speak Moisha? Go ahead.
I think that what you'll find with most people doing low light is, the kind of outdoor pictures and things like that, you're not going to find that low light and overhead, you know, kind of bulbs are going to be, you know, the same scenarios. And I think that that's a decision Apple made. I think you're absolutely right that there's not going to be much in the way of green filter. But I think that they cover a pretty significant group of users with this improvement.
All right, Moshe, thanks a lot for that call. We appreciate it. A lot of people have been talking about, and you've brought it up already, the Touch ID fingerprint unlocking of the phone. I think that would be pretty cool, but how big of a deal is it really? Is it sort of just a bell and a whistle type of thing, or is it heading in a direction that's going to change how we use these things?
It is a big deal for people like me who are absolutely frustrated with the concept of entering their password any time they have to purchase anything on iTunes.
Well, then it's me. You're talking about me. Just say
so
it.
The idea here is that anytime you go to purchase something on iTunes or or the App Store, you have to punch in your password. And if you're someone like me, you've got a pretty long password. This allows you to slide your finger over the home button. And again, assuming the technology works the way Apple says it does, you'll be able to place your thumb on the button and the purchase will be complete. You won't have to enter in your password and it'll be done. And that's something that, you know, has always kind of bugged me, but I get that the security is there. And as I am one of those parents that will often hand my phone to my child, it seems like a pretty big deal.
That's a big deal. Getting into the phone, it doesn't bother me punching in four digits.
Right.
But the ID stuff every time you want to buy something is, wow. Okay. Thank you for enlightening me. What about Siri?
Siri got an incremental upgrade. And you have to keep in mind that, Siri was a technology that Apple purchased and then kind of integrated into their operating system. So I think right now what they're trying to figure out how to do is kind of add extra resources to it to get better results. And that's what we saw with this Apple announcement. We've got the announcement that they made, with Bing, where they're getting, Bing results, when iOS 7 was announced. And then we've got some updates that came from Twitter. Now you'll be able to get Twitter results added in. It's basically adding knowledge sources so that Siri can give you better answers is what this ends up being. And that's something that, Apple needs in order to continue competing with Google now and then eventually with Microsoft when they announce their service that is kind of geared in the same direction. So that's the update that we saw. And it'll either be really good and it'll be a huge improvement, or it'll be, kind of a marginal upgrade to what we've already seen.
Yeah, because I still go back to those Siri videos and laugh. The guy jogging down the street, planning his entire life. Siri's right there with them. It just doesn't happen that way. It might be my voice, though. All right. So tomorrow, the new operating system, the iOS 7, comes out. What are the significant changes that people?
Huge, huge changes. But most of them are visual, which is kind of the worst because people are going to see it and go, oh, everything is different. You'll be able to install iOS 7 on just about every modern Apple device. I think if you have a 3GS, you're now officially off the list. But if you've got a 4 or a 4S or one of the iPads, then you'll be able to grab this update. It shouldn't take too long. It'll reboot your phone and it'll bring you into the next version of the operating system. At the end of the day, it's going to be a huge visual update. Everything is going to be kind of softer colors. There's going to be this thing called parallax backgrounds, where the background's going to feel like it moves with you when you move the phone. It's a lot of very small visual changes that are ultimately really nice looking, but it is going to be kind of jarring at first because things are going to be very, very different.
Okay, so listeners out there with the iPhones who can go to the iOS 7, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do this, and I want people next week, let's talk about what we think about it.
You have my cell phone in case you need to call me when everything falls.
I definitely have your cell phone. but I'm going to do this, and I want other listeners out there to do it too so we can talk about it next week I usually don't do updates because I'm too dang lazy. And I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this. So because I can. I have a 4S.
Yeah.
So what the heck, right?
Absolutely.
Really quick, Rick in Grandview, we have about 30 seconds.
Okay. Assume I have the ability for delayed gratification. Why would I want to wait for the iPhone 6?
Should he wait for the iPhone 6?
There's no way to say why you would want to wait for the iPhone 6. I can't possibly tell you what's going to come next from a year ahead. Huh. You know, Apple's made a lot of really interesting moves this year. So the next year is going to be, you know, a big deal as far as, you know, camera and possibly display. But I can't say much of anything else.
Okay, our Apple hour has ended. Russell Holley, thank you so much for talking with us today about it. I appreciate it.
Not in time.
Russell Holley's tech blogger at geek.com. He is our favorite regular on the show. Thanks for listening to Tech Tuesday today on All Sides with Dan Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.
Support comes from the law firm of Thompson Hine, delivering employee benefit solutions uniquely suited for your business. More information about Thompson Hine's employee benefits practice can be found online at thompsonhine.com.